Pharmacy Podcast Network.
This is the ACMA Podcast. Career opportunities for pharmacists in the pharmaceutical industry have never been better. Are you interested in breaking into the industry? It can be competitive. You must distinguish yourself. The Accreditation Council for Medical Affairs, or the ACMA, offers the only specialized board certification for healthcare professionals to help prepare them for roles such as medical science liaison, medical director, drug information experts, and more. The Board Certified Medical Affairs Specialists, or BCMAS program, is an online, self-paced program recognized worldwide as the industry standard and has been featured on the Pharmacy Podcast Network, Forbes, ABC News, The Pharmaceutical Executive, and Yahoo Finance. Become a Board Certified Medical Affairs Specialist and build your professional brand. Learn more. Go to medicalaffairsspecialist.org.
Hello, I'm Jeff Pike, and welcome to the first episode of the Millennial Pharma Leader podcast. Millennial Pharma Leader is an online magazine that I founded with my colleague Ben Penley in August of 2018. Both of us are students focused on pursuing careers in the pharmaceutical industry. As we learned about the huge variety of opportunities in this field, we were surprised that there really weren't a lot of resources telling students and starting professionals how to get involved. So we took it upon ourselves to bridge the gap. Together with a team of talented authors, we have worked hard to bring regular content by millennials for millennials. Our goal is to share the stories of our most successful peers and mentors. Hopefully, these stories, interviews, and topic discussions will be informative and help you paint a better picture of the opportunities for ambitious new professionals in the drug development sector. Before we get started with today's podcast guest, I would like to give a special thanks to our partner, the Accreditation Council for Medical Affairs. The ACMA is all about raising the bar among physicians, pharmacists, and scientists in the pharmaceutical industry. And of course, they're known for offering the only board certification program for medical affairs professionals and medical science liaisons. You can learn more about them by visiting their website, medicalaffairsspecialist.org. In this first episode, I'm joined by Colin Watson. Colin graduated with a dual MBA-MHA not too long ago and is in the middle of a leadership rotational program in the pharmaceutical industry. We cover an awesome variety of topics, including his educational background and work experience, his passion for drug development, some of the work he has done already in strategy and marketing, current healthcare policy trends, and his key words of advice for future pharma professionals. So kick back and relax, and if you enjoy this episode, be sure to tell your friends about it and subscribe at millpharmaleader.com. That's millpharmaleader.com. Hello, I'm Jeff Pike with Millennial Pharma Leader. And here with me today is Colin Watson. Colin is the Commercial Strategy and Operations Lead of Puerto Rico with GlaxoSmithKline, and he has been working in the healthcare industry for over 9 years. He's worked in pharmaceuticals, inpatient, and outpatient health administration, as well as health IT. Colin, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. It's really a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to share some of my thoughts and talk through careers in pharma. So thank you for having me.
Awesome. Perfect. So we are really excited to have you. And today we're going to talk a little bit about your educational journey, what got you interested and involved in the pharmaceutical industry, especially, and some of the learning curves that you've come across along the way that you can perhaps take what you've learned from those experiences and share them with the next generation who'd love to follow in your footsteps.
Sure. Yeah, happy to share.
Awesome. So we'll start with your educational journey. Could you give us a little bit of a background on that?
Sure. So I went to Elon University in North Carolina, and I got an undergraduate degree in finance. And then I went and worked for a couple of years and came back to get a master's in healthcare administration from UNC Chapel Hill. I also got a master's in business administration from UNC Chapel Hill.
Very cool. And so coming from the bachelor in finance, what was the transition that got you interested in the MHA, the Master of Healthcare or Health Administration?
Yeah, that's a question I get a lot. So the undergrad, the bachelor's in finance that I got wasn't because I wanted to go work for the bank. The reason I got a degree in finance was because I knew that in any business, you were going to have to understand the books. You're going to have to understand the income statement and the balance sheet and the accounting processes that go on if you want to run the business.
Right.
So for that reason, I got the degree in finance, and the MBA and MHA were tools for me to learn even more about the MHA specifically about the healthcare field and what opportunities might be available there.
Gotcha. And what was it that sparked that interest in the pharmaceutical industry? What opportunities or things attracted you to that?
So I've worked in healthcare since I was in high school. I mean, I got a job in a doctor's office, and I was doing, you know, the most basic tasks you can do. And that's where I started to grow my interest in healthcare. From then, I worked in a hospital. Then I did some internships in hospital administration and different things like that. But there was something that was missing from it. And the things that I found in pharma that I wasn't finding in other areas of healthcare, the first one was there's a ton of innovation in pharma. I mean, you talked about early when you were doing the introduction, the R&D and the development of drugs. There's new drugs constantly coming into the marketplace. The second one was I wanted a multinational career. I love experiencing new cultures. I love stretching myself in ways that I really didn't foresee. And so a multinational corporation allows me the opportunity to do that. Many pharma companies, if not all of them, are. And then the last one is the scope, right? So hospitals, I loved working in hospitals, but you're having an effect on a very defined set of people within your community. Whereas in a pharma organization, you're affecting the entire world. You have these drugs that are curing Hep C. We're talking about malaria vaccines. We're changing HIV drug regimens. Those are things that change people's lives on a global scale. And so that's what I really liked about pharma.
That's really cool. Colin, what were the biggest learning curves for you transitioning from student to professional?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I mentioned that I've been working pretty much my entire life. So I think the transition for me was less shocking than it might be if you had gone from, you know, not working, being a full-time student only, to going to the workforce. But that being said, in my scenario, I think the biggest transition has been in my personal life. When you're in school, you have the opportunity to make a whole bunch of friends. Everybody around you is probably similar to your age. They have similar interests and educational backgrounds. But once you get into the workforce, the vast majority of your time is spent at your job. So if you work with people who are a lot older than you, then it becomes harder to, you know, make friends outside of work and meet new people, especially in a job in pharma like mine, where you're moving constantly. You know, I move every year or every 6 months. So I'm always having to make new friends wherever I go. And without the school structure around you, that becomes more difficult. But it's also a challenge. It's a challenge to be more outgoing and test yourself in ways that you haven't been tested before.
Gotcha. So you had already had professional exposure before getting your first pharmaceutical job. You had worked in other industries before and through school?
Yes, exactly. I worked at UNC Hospital actually while I was in undergraduate school. And then once I graduated, I became a consultant for what is now called KPMG. I did electronic medical records consulting for large academic medical centers.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. What sort of experience did you get at the hospital that translated to the EHR consulting?
So the thing that I understood best was the workflows, or what we call them, the workflows that you go through in a hospital to do everything from admitting a patient, discharging a patient, writing the orders. When you're setting up a new electronic medical record, so much of what you do is focused on making all those processes as easy for the end user as possible. And having a very good understanding and having lived through those processes helps quite a bit when you're trying to achieve that goal. So I think that was definitely the most helpful thing I learned in those hospital inpatient jobs.
I see. And then you did the consulting before the MHA and the MBA?
Yeah. So once I finished the consulting, I went straight into my MHA program and I did a dual degree MHA MBA. So that took 3 years. Upon graduation, I started at GlaxoSmithKline.
Gotcha. Well, that's a really powerful combo, I feel like. It really covers your bases with the MHA.
I think it was a good match to get a little bit on the provider side, you know, understanding the provider side, and then also then move into the industry of, you know, the pharmaceutical industry.
Absolutely. So coming out with the MHA and the MBA, what sort of role did you get recruited for right into GlaxoSmithKline?
I started in a role as a product manager for a brand, an immunology brand. And a lot of what that is is what you would consider typical marketing. So you are doing customer segmentation, trying to understand who your customer is, what they care about, how you talk to them and how they need to be talked to, what sorts of offerings they're going to want to see from a pharmaceutical company. It also deals with things like logistics. How do you make sure that your customers are getting the products that they need at the right time and that they're not expired and all of those things? So it's sort of my first role touched many, many different parts of the business, from payer to logistics to marketing to medical, pretty much almost every part of the business you can think of it touched.
Very cool. And what sorts of other functional areas were involved in your day-to-day role? Working in marketing, what other departments did you have to collaborate with to pursue those objectives?
Yeah, it really depends on the day. Well, in that role, so I'm no longer in that role, but when I was in that role, it depended on the day. It would be, you know, if I were putting through a new journal ad to go into one of the journals that any of our doctors would subscribe to, I would have to work with our legal partners to make sure all of the wording and all of the images and everything fit the legal needs that we had as a company. I needed to meet with regulatory to make sure it was compliant with all of the FDA rules and regulations. I would need to meet with medical to make sure that all of what we had in our content was medically accurate and not misleading. So really, depending on the product, you could touch any part of the business, sales or operations. I also worked a lot with IT when building things like websites. You touch almost every part of the business when you're in marketing at a pharmaceutical company.
Gotcha. And were you dealing with products that were already on the market typically, or was this earlier in the process? Or
yeah, I worked with both. So I worked with a product that was already on the market. I also worked to launch a product as it was coming to market. So I worked on it for the months right up until launch, and then launching that product and seeing it through its first year, I guess you would call it its infancy. So I saw both sides of the business there.
That's pretty dynamic time to be in that marketing department when it's right coming out on the market and having to navigate all of figuring out what do the physicians think about it? What do patients need? Identifying those pain points and making sure the medicine actually, that the patients have access to it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So how long were you working in marketing roles, or are you still?
No. So I worked in that role for a year, and then I transitioned to the role that I have now, which you mentioned is the commercial strategy and operations lead for all of our Puerto Rico business.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me about that role.
Yeah, this role is more operational in nature and strategic, as the name implies. The things that I'm responsible for, they are things like launching, we're getting it back into oncology, Glaxo. So what's going to be the strategy for launching our oncology assets here on the island? Mm-hmm. I'm also responsible for analyzing our sales force. So how many sales people do we need to support our various products based on the strategies that we have for those products, as well as what is the structure of that sales force need to look like? I'm responsible for leading our strategic planning process. So every year, our brands go through a strat planning process to examine the landscape of Puerto Rico, the environment, and the competitive landscape. And then we take all of those things to build product strategic plans for our various products. So I lead that work as well.
That's really cool. So, what's a project that you've worked on in that role that you really enjoyed? And can you tell us a little bit about the hard and soft skills you had to utilize and who you had to collaborate with to get the job done?
Yeah. So I'll talk about our project from a previous role, because a lot of the projects that I have in Puerto Rico role are ongoing and some of them are sensitive. But so in a prior role, I was dealing with, I was asked to create a key opinion leader engagement strategy. So a key opinion leader, for anybody who wouldn't know what that is a very influential clinician in your therapeutic area. So I was asked to put together a strategy for how do we engage those people and get them to be advocates of the brand. Mm-hmm. The project, you know, it started out, I did interviews of key opinion leaders as well as internal interviews of our medical staff. And it was quite eye-opening to find that our product was viewed in quite a negative light. It was viewed as not providing high quality medical education. having gaps in our data or not, you know, not releasing the data that we had in a timely manner. There were a lot of negative perceptions about the company and about the brand. So it was quite eye-opening. And so when you ask about the soft skills needed to do a project like that, people don't like to hear what they didn't do well. And so the biggest soft skill that you're using there is bringing people together to solve a problem without people getting defensive and sort of tearing down the process. There's a lot of bringing them along early, making sure their input gets collected as you're doing the interviews, which is why I did the internal interviews for that. There's a lot of emotional skills that are required, a lot of empathy.
Right, because you're basically saying you're taking this feedback that you have gaps in sort of the body of publication literature out there, and you're having to communicate that to the people who generated that material, and basically tell them that, you know, what you envisioned isn't quite having the effect we want. How can we improve upon that?
That's the gist of what I had to do. It's challenging. It's very challenging.
Right. Gosh. So what was the outcome of that? How did you guys bring it together?
Yeah. So it helped that I had interviewed the medical staff to get their opinion before releasing all this data. They're also, I scheduled a lot of one-on-one conversations as opposed to surprising people in meetings in front of their counterparts. I mean, that could be quite embarrassing, right? If you're in a meeting with 15 other people that are leading the business and I'm saying that your department's not doing well. So there were a lot of one-on-one conversations. Right. Ultimately, what happened was we got everybody together. We put together a strategic plan to say, these are our three areas of focus to improve the perception of the brand amongst key opinion leaders. And then we started to ladder up and build tactics against those brand, those strategies, which are now being executed currently.
Nice. That's pretty cool to work on something with teammates and see it actually get implemented.
Yeah, for sure. That was one of the things I missed in consulting. Consulting, there was no real execution. It was a lot of strategic thinking and planning, but no execution. The nice thing about these roles is you're doing both sides of the work.
So now that you're in strategy and operations, do you kind of have a hand in both figuring out the direction to go and also executing on that?
Yeah, I do. And it's a really interesting position to be in, because in most roles, those two functions are separated. Mm-hmm. But what this provides me the opportunity to do is I see the project, its whole life cycle, from the inception of the project all the way to the execution of the project. It's been really eye-opening. It's been a really good learning experience.
Absolutely. Very cool. So, you know, we've gotten a lot of attention on the pharmaceutical industry in the last few years, especially with drug pricing and health legislation and reform probably targeted at that and figuring out how we can bring it down. Has any of this sort of extra attention impacted your job on a daily basis or on a regular basis?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, so first and foremost, that's one of the reasons I love working in pharma, because it's such a dynamic industry where things are changing and you're having to adapt all the time. I mean, it makes it a really exciting time, and this is a really exciting time to work in pharma. But yes, certainly pricing pressures, all of those things affect my, maybe not my day-to-day role, but it definitely affects my job. So for instance, if I'm planning an oncology launch in Puerto Rico, I need to be thinking about the fact that there's a lot of sensitivity to high-priced specialty medications in the marketplace right now, especially in a place like Puerto Rico, where you have 70% of the island living under the federal poverty level. So while those things may not be day-to-day things I'm thinking about, they definitely affect the different roles, the different functions that I'm doing, especially on the more strategic projects that I have.
Right. It's it's tough, because there are so many stakeholders involved. You want to make sure that patients have access to this medicine. You want to make sure that the physicians and people have access, formulary access, to actually prescribe this medicine, which is part of that patient access. And you know, it's obviously a company. You have to plan ahead and price to account for what, 14, 15 years of R&D on average. And all the, you know, it's the cost of innovation on a certain level. And
it's a very, very complex topic. I wrote my master's thesis on pharma pricing, and nice. It's it's just not as simple as it seems as many things aren't. It's just not as simple as it seems at the surface. I mean, for one, it's a very complex system where money is changing hands through multiple parties, be it retail pharmacies, PBMs, manufacturers, government. There's money changing hands there. The WAC price, the price that everybody gets shown, is the list price, whatever you want to call it, is not really, it doesn't really tell you much. So there's a lot of what I consider to be misinformation out there, but it's a lot of confusion, even on the part of people who are working in the pharmaceutical industry. It's a very complicated issue to address.
Absolutely. That makes a whole lot of sense. My organization, we have what's called a P&T competition each year. And we look at all the clinical data behind a drug, as well as all the economic data, and having to sort through that and figure out, you know, there's the list price, but what does that actually mean in terms of what the PBM is going to spend? You know, how are we thinking about rebates, and how will this shift the market share of everything else that's on the formulary? And having, you know, it's a complex web. It really is. Complicated supply chain, and a lot of stakeholders who are contributing value to it. So having to make sure that everyone's compensated while patients still get a decent price, you know, it's important. So I guess kind of following up on that, recently there's been some discussion of mandating it, basically, that pharmaceutical companies have to list their wholesale, or the list price, I think it is, for DTC, consumer, direct to consumer advertisements. What are your thoughts on that? And, you know, would that increase price transparency like they want it to, or is that an election ploy sort of thing?
So it's an interesting idea that's been floated and is the topic of a lot of conversation right now in pharmaceutical, I'm sure, boardrooms. Mm-hmm. But so I was reading up on this the other day, and even organizations that you would say are in favor of very transparent pharma pricing, some of them are against this. And so the reason being, let's say I have a drug that costs $2,000 as a list price. That $2,000 list price doesn't really tell you anything about what you're going to be paying for the drug. And so their argument was, you're disincentivizing people to going to get the drugs. If they see online on TV that this drug is going to cost them $2,000, if that's the initial thought, right off bat, they're not going to get the medication. They're already canceling that out as an option. And that's not what you want people to do. What you really would want in an ideal world is for them to know exactly what they're going to be paying, but it's not as simple as just putting the list price up on there, because there are so many different factors that come into play when you're figuring out what somebody's going to pay. So I think the idea of pricing transparency is definitely the right way to go. I think people deserve to know how much a drug is going to cost them before they buy it, like any other good. But I don't know that list prices are the way to do that, because they don't really tell you much as a consumer.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. What do you think about direct-to-consumer advertising in general? So I kind of see it as, you know, when you're marketing a medicine, you have to get the word out there to all the potential stakeholders, right? So there's the patients, and I guess that's really what the direct-to-consumer advertising is trying to get the word out to. And you're also advertising to physicians. What are your thoughts, and sort of what are the different major marketing channels, and, you know, is it important to target all of them, or how do they sort of intersect?
When you ask about the different marketing channels, do you mean what are the different ways we reach consumers, patients?
Patients, but other stakeholders as well. You know, and why is it important to get the word out to each constituent?
So it's interesting. The U.S. and I believe one other market, I can't remember off the top of my head the other market, but there's only two, I believe, that allow direct-to-consumer advertising.
Is it Australia?
I wouldn't venture a guess because So I think it's a double-edged, there's two sides to it, like most things. On the one side, you would hope your physicians are making the best medical decisions for their patient. And so I can see the argument that physicians, there should be no need for direct-to-consumer advertising because physicians should know what their patients are going to be needing, right? But on the other hand, you also want informed consumers. I personally wouldn't want to go into a doctor's office without any information or understanding of the different options that I have in treating my therapy. I think healthcare in general is moving to a place where consumers are making more and more decisions in their healthcare, becoming bigger parts of the healthcare discussion and becoming partners in their care as opposed to being dictated to what they should be taking. So I think that direct-to-consumer advertising, disease state awareness advertising, where you're helping people understand the disease without promoting products, I think those things are helpful in educating consumers about the options that are available to them. But there's also responsibility there for the doctor to help the patient sift through the noise and understand which of those options is best for them.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. I think we are moving into an era where consumers are doing a lot more research. They're doing their diligence, their due diligence when it comes to the purchases they're making. And of course, healthcare is becoming a ever more important piece of that. I think people care about it a little bit more than they used to generationally. And health literacy is, it's definitely not great. It's nowhere near where we want it to be, but more and more patients seem to be coming into clinics and being informed about their options. And I would agree with you. I think it also sort of, it puts a sort of competitive pressure on physicians to keep up with the current literature and the current options in their disease state, right? Because they know patients are going to be coming in and asking them about these new medicines, and they need to be prepared for those questions.
Yeah, and you would be amazed at how much of whether a patient starts on a medication. I guess this could be for good or for bad, but a lot of whether or not a patient starts on a medication for some medications is, does the patient go in and initiate the discussion? Because if you're a doctor and you're thinking about 40 different things, you're not just thinking about medication for X ailment. You're thinking about smoking cessation and all sorts of things. So you need somebody, in some cases, you need the patient to push for the conversation to happen if they want to get, if their treatment's not working, or if they need a new treatment for a new ailment that hasn't been discussed. A lot of those discussions are initiated by a patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's potentially, I definitely don't think DTC ads are going to go anywhere, given that sort of trend toward consumer research and being an informed patient. But I do think that, I think it keeps doctors accountable. I think it's a positive pressure, but I know it's a hot topic. So while we're discussing prices, while I have your expertise, I'll just hit you with one more question in this domain. I also recently saw some buzz that the current administration is considering a policy, basically, for international reference pricing.
Yeah,
where we look at the prices that other countries are paying and using that to negotiate prices back home. And I know that's something that lots of countries throughout Europe and other places are already engaging in. It's kind of a novel concept in the U.S. What are your thoughts on how that might be implemented here?
Yeah, I think if I'm remembering correctly, that legislation is specific to Medicare Part B. I think reference pricing makes sense, but what you have to remember is that, as you said earlier, development of a pharma asset requires a lot of money on the front end to build the asset, to test out other assets that may not make it through the pipeline, the vast majority of which don't make it through the pipeline. So I think that it makes sense to have some sort of reference pricing and make sure that the U.S. isn't carrying the load, as some people would say, for the rest of the world. But what you don't want to do is end up pushing prices so far down and focusing so much on prices that you end up stifling innovation, the innovation that pharmaceutical companies are able to provide. So right. I think there's a balance. I'm not against reference pricing inherently. I also would say that a lot of medications are paid for. A lot of the pharmaceutical spend in the U.S. is coming from commercial plans, which they wouldn't use reference pricing. You know, that's a much more competitive model where you're basically bartering with them over how many lives that they cover and how much power they hold. There's a lot of buying power that those PBMs have. So I think Medicare Part B and reference pricing, that makes sense. But there's also another, you got to keep your eye also on the bigger part of the business, which would be the commercial business.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that is also just a reflection of the kind of the current state of things. The U.S. pricing in general is reflective of the fact that a lot of the innovation in medicines is taking place here, right? We are in a way funding a lot of the innovation for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
When they're using single payer systems and can kind of leverage that market access to achieve lower pricing.
Yeah, sure. But there are also, many countries that don't have the drugs that the U.S. has. You know, there may be, and I've seen this happen plenty of times, where there's a drug that's available in the U.S., we go to market to, or we go to into negotiations with the U.K., and the U.K., we can't come off on a price that is agreeable, and then the U.K. doesn't have access to the drug, or we don't have access in the U.K., is how we would say it in pharma. So then patients don't have access to the product. So it's a balance.
And that's tough. That's it's the give and take of how do you want to structure your healthcare, right? I guess NICE, that's their price watchdog over there. Is that right? Yeah. They can keep prices low, and that's good for a population average. But for those who would have been willing to use that medicine, they have to pay full price now if they have access to it at all.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Very, very cool. So, now looking at your background, it's cool that you started off with very specialized education. You learned the ins and outs of finance and then transitioned to getting a more broad understanding of management and also the healthcare industry. What are your thoughts on breadth versus depth in experience and education, particularly when it comes to the pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah, so for education, I would focus on depth within bounds, right? So depth in healthcare or depth in business, whatever it is. So my background is in pharma. So for me, I would say depth in business and depth in the healthcare system. If I were going to be a pharmacist, it would be depth in biology, depth in chemistry, depth in the sciences that you need to be a good pharmacist.
Right.
So I would say I would definitely encourage depth in your education. And also, if we're talking specifically to the commercial pharma business, which is what I know, I would say that the discussion on whether you need breadth or depth of experience depends on where you want to end up. If you want to end up being a general manager or a CEO of a pharmaceutical company, you're definitely going to need breadth of experience. You need to know how sales works. You need to know how marketing works. You need to know how payer works and contracts with insurance companies. So in that scenario, mm-hmm. you would need breadth.
Right.
But if you want to be a VP of payer marketing, for example, you probably really want to get a lot of exposure into payer, because that's a very complex space with complex contracting, a lot of different players and different partners outside of the company that you need to work with. So I would say for commercial pharma, if you're thinking about breadth versus depth, the first question you need to ask is, where do I want to end up? And that question will help you answer whether or not you need breadth or depth.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And of course, it's specific to where do you want to go? What is your career target?
Right.
It makes sense if you're trying to become an R&D chemist and want to learn how to create the next major medicine. Molecularly, that's a lot of depth there, but
exactly, yeah.
But then, general management's the opposite. That's really a good and a thoughtful response. Thanks for kind of walking us through your thought process there. Another thing I want to touch on, I know you're the commercial lead, commercial operations lead in Puerto Rico. What kind of led to that transition? Did you voluntarily want to go to that location, or was that sort of the next opening that made sense for you?
So I'm part of a rotational program, which affords me the opportunity to change roles every year. And this role, I had a couple of options to go to various places, everything ranging from, Russia to New Zealand. Wow. So there were a lot of options on the table. None of them really fit what I wanted, both personally and professionally. But there was a role that was coming open in Puerto Rico that I knew I wanted to get some deeper understanding of the high level thinking, what we would call above brand thinking. So business level strategic planning, and then also understanding how we put together our sales teams. I wanted both of those things, and this role was perfect for that. And then they told me it was in Puerto Rico, and I'm not going to turn down the opportunity to work in the Caribbean. So it was a perfect role for me. And so I came over here and started.
That's really cool. And, for those who don't know, I was doing some background reading on this. The pharmaceutical industry in Puerto Rico is actually pretty huge, right?
It's a very big part of the island, the island's infrastructure and our economy. And it's also increasingly important now after you had the devastation of Hurricane Maria and the economy's been in recession. You know, where the U.S. came out of recession in 2000 and after 2007, Puerto Rico never came out of that recession. So the pharmaceutical industry is even more important now. The island's in sort of a tough time.
Yeah, I'm reading here that it generates more than 18,000 jobs and pays $3 billion a year in taxes.
That's half
of total exports. That's a pretty predominant industry there. How badly are things impacted at the office when a hurricane strikes? How does that go?
Yeah, it depends on the hurricane. I mean, for Maria, it was pretty horrible. I wasn't here at the time, but I know that our office was destroyed by water damage. They were working out of the hotel in the Sheraton. I mean, you have to remember, people only just got power back in some places of Puerto Rico a couple of months ago. So you're talking about people going a year without power. There was somebody in my office that only got power back in, I think, September.
Wow.
So not only are you talking about people in their jobs, like, you know, the corporate space was messed up, but you're also talking about people's lives, their homes, their family members. I mean, a lot of people here, this is an elderly population, it's an aging population. So you've got people who are worried about getting their parents to doctor's appointments if their doctor's offices are open. I mean, it just affected people's, the effect on people's lives was unmeasurable, really. And it was devastating to the island, but Puerto Rican people are very, very resilient. And it's amazing to me to see how quickly they've been able to rebound and rebuild and how positive the people are here on the island. It's really amazing to see.
Well, that's great to hear. And I don't know if you kind of touch the manufacturing side at all, but it seems like every time, after every major hurricane, there is always a huge drug shortage.
Yeah.
Afterwards, I'm sure that takes some time to kind of rebuild and repair, but it kind of goes to show you how crucial Puerto Rico is to the whole industry.
Exactly. Yep. That's very true. When you were talking about the size of the Puerto Rican, the contribution to the Puerto Rican economy from pharma, a lot of that comes from manufacturing facilities here on the island.
Gotcha. So for you personally, what sorts of future aspirations do you have in the industry? What are some of the potential next steps for you?
Yeah. The way I break down next steps, so in the next 3 years, I'd love to get back into marketing. I'd like to be a marketing director on a product. As I said, marketing touches a lot of the business. You learn a lot about the different areas. And that will help me because in 10 years, I'd like to be a GM. Again, I told you that I really like exploring new cultures and doing things that sort of take me out of my comfort zone. So I'd love to be the GM of a country, maybe in Southeast Asia or Latin America in the next 10 years. Being a marketing director will help me get there. After that, I think it becomes a lot hazier and harder to project what you want to do. 10 years is, well, it seems far away now. I'm sure it'll fly by, but ultimately, if I'm sitting here now, my goal would be to be the CEO of a pharmaceutical company. But, you know, it's really easy to say that before you have familial obligations or any other responsibilities that pop up later on in life. So for now, that's the plan, but I definitely know that it's subject to change.
That's always a pretty cool goal to have. Do you feel like to really, is there sort of a level, a ceiling that you hit where to go beyond that and assume more responsibility? Or do you feel like there's a point where you have to start sacrificing other areas of your life?
I think that is highly dependent on the type of life you have. If you are responsible, if you're the main person, let's say you have a family and you have kids and you're the main person responsible for picking up your kids from work every day and helping them with their homework, I would imagine that there comes a point where sacrifices have to be made. But I've seen people in the pharmaceutical industry in leadership positions in all sorts of different situations, you know, some with kids, some without kids, some with spouses that take care of the work, some they take care of the housework themselves. I mean, I think it is very dependent on the type of person you are, how much sleep you need, what kind of, you know, family structure you have, or what kind of life you have set up for yourself. I think it's very dependent.
Thanks, Colin. This has been a really, really awesome interview. We've gotten a lot of great advice and thoughts and perspectives on the pharmaceutical industry as a whole, and your journey has provided some really great insights. Before we part, do you have any final thoughts or words of advice for other would-be millennial pharma leaders?
I think I'll give two, and again, these are specific to my experience in commercial pharma, right? So I wouldn't say that these maybe go out to R&D and all these other areas. Maybe they do, but I wouldn't say that necessarily. Sure. But anyway, the first one I would say would be to be as open as possible to new experiences, new challenges. I talked about this a couple of times already, but if somebody wants to send you to Indonesia to run a sales team and your life circumstances, as we just discussed, if those allow you to do it, then I would say don't think about whether or not you can do it. You know, if somebody's asked you to do it, it's because they believe in you. Mm-hmm. Jump in. And even though if it doesn't fit into your plan, you know, there are a lot of things, you know, detours and things like that, that may actually set you on a path better than the one that you had originally set for yourself. So the first thing I would say is be very open to new and challenging experiences. The second one is one that I've learned over the last year and a half. And it's that when you jump onto a new team, the most valuable thing you can do in some scenarios is speak up. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, so this is a little bit complicated because on the one hand, you need to stay humble, and you don't want to jump in and assume you know better than everybody else. But there are a lot of times when you'll jump onto a team and you'll see something that you say, well, why don't you do it this way? Or this doesn't really make sense to me. And I would encourage people, instead of sitting and thinking, well, certainly somebody's thought of this, I'm not going to speak up and ask why this is. I don't want to sound dumb. I would encourage people to speak up, ask the question, hey, why is it that we are doing it this way instead of that way? A lot of times the most valuable thing that you bring to an organization as one new to the pharmaceutical industry or new to a team is a fresh perspective, a fresh set of eyes. And people who have been on the team for quite a while, a lot of times they become blind to things. They're focused on what they're doing and they don't see that things may be able to change. So I would just say the worst case scenario, you ask the question, there's a reasonable explanation, you learn something. In the best case scenario, you've found a way for your team to work more efficiently and you've started adding value as soon as you get in the door. So that would be my second piece of advice.
Great parting words. Colin, thank you so much. This has been awesome. I look forward to staying in touch with you and wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors.
Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate the opportunity to sit down and talk to you today, man. It was really good. Thanks.
That's great. Thanks.
We thank you for listening to the ACMA Podcast, part of the Pharmacy Podcast Network. To learn more about medical affairs and new career opportunities, please go to acmapodcast.com.